It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, Politics Wednesday edition of our program. In just a minute, we'll get to our analysts, Dennis Goldford and Tim Hagel. But before we do that, of course, there was the debate last night featuring candidates repeatedly shouting over one another, ignoring their time limits. Bernie Sanders' opponents painting him as a risky choice to face Donald Trump in November. Let's talk quickly with Thalicia Eady. She's a reporter and producer at South Carolina Public Radio. Hi, Thalicia.
Hey, Ben. How are you?
I'm well. Big night there in South Carolina with the debate. Can you tell us anything about how it was received by South Carolinians?
Yeah, I think a lot of people, as you mentioned, of course, the shouting and the ignoring the time limits, I think a lot of folks were a little irritated by that. But again, people are really ready to have their voices heard. People here in South Carolina have been waiting for their chance to be noticed, and a lot of voters here want their issues and what they are concerned about to be heard. And people that I've talked to and folks who have been posting on social media are really excited about what they saw in the candidates last night, and they are ready to head to the polls this Saturday to make their voices heard even louder.
Mm-hmm. This is a pivotal testing ground there in South Carolina for these candidates, especially Joe Biden, it seems. He predicted last night that he would win South Carolina. He got a key endorsement today, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Earlier this week, Congressman Clyburn said that he would announce his endorsement after Tuesday's debate in Charleston. And this morning, as promised, he delivered. He actually announced at a technical school not far from last night's debate. And, you know, Ben, many people speculated that this was going to happen, that Clyburn was going to endorse Biden. They have this longstanding personal and professional relationship. And in an endorsement video that's posted to Biden's Twitter page, Clyburn says that he knows Joe Biden. He knows his character. He touched on that personal friendship. He said he knows his heart and his record. And then he tied in many of the concerns and issues that Biden and the rest of the candidates desperately tried to connect with South Carolina voters on last night. And I think this is a really big win for him because, you know, the first out of Clyburn's mouth was he was reinforcing that tie with the nation's first black president. And he said that Biden was going to build on President Obama's legacy. He was going to protect and expand the Affordable Care Act, which is a really big issue for voters here, especially African-American voters here, because, you know, South Carolina is one of 14 states that turned down federal money to expand the Medicare program, Medicaid program. And then also in that endorsement video, we hear from Clyburn talking about the NRA. And last night's debate then took place just blocks away from Mother Emanuel Church. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's where nine black worshipers were murdered by young white supremacists.
Right.
We saw Biden last night trying to, you know, spar with Sanders on his record with the NRA and how, you know, things could have been differently if certain legislation was in place. I think it's a big win for Biden. We saw him tweeting this morning. He said that Clyburn's voice of powerful moral clarity is heard loud and clear across the country. I think the question now is whether that voice and the message it carries in South Carolina and throughout the country will translate into the votes that Biden needs. Part of that question is going to be answered here on Saturday.
Okay, Thalicia Eady, just 3-4 days away from the South Carolina primary, talking there about the endorsement of former Vice President Joe Biden, announced today by Democratic Representative James Clyburn of South Carolina, top-ranking African-American in the House from a state with a huge and powerful black voting bloc. Thalicia, how many in this Democratic primary, quickly before we say goodbye, how many black voters?
Here, black voters make up about 61% of the Democratic electorate here in South Carolina.
Okay, Thalicia.
Pretty big block.
Thanks for the information on the ground there in South Carolina. Thalicia Eady with South Carolina Public Radio. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Ben.
Well, let's get to our analysts on this edition of River to River Politics, a Wednesday edition. Dennis Goldford joining us, professor of political science at Drake University in Des Moines. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Ben.
Tim Hagel, also with us, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa, joining us from the Iowa City studio. Hi, Tim.
Hey there.
Well, let's get your impressions of last night's debate. Let me read a few headlines. A Bernie slayer fails to emerge at Tuesday's debate. Another headline, combative mood at messy forum in South Carolina. Biden fought, Sanders took heat. For those, I know both of you, Dennis and Tim, both of you watched every minute of last night's debate, but for those who didn't, here's 20 seconds that will sum up
a lot of what the debate was about.
Ours will cost about $45 billion, not $60
trillion. No, I was talking about...
We are never said it. Period. End of story.
If we spend the next 4 months tearing our party apart, we're going to watch Donald Trump spend the next 4 years tearing our country apart.
Okay, a couple of excerpts there. An unruly debate much of the time between the seven Democrats speaking over one another. The CBS moderators had their hands full to direct this conversation. Dennis, what are your takeaways from that debate?
I think those were the most painful 2 hours of my professional life. It was really disastrous. Before looking, perhaps, if you wish, at individual candidates, I would say, broadly speaking, there were no winners. There were simply losers. The prime losers were the viewing audience, the people who really wanted to find out something more about these candidates, what distinguishes them, and who might make the best candidate to take on a sitting incumbent president. The moderators did a miserable job.
Right.
I have moderated forums and debates, and it's not about me. It's not about the moderator. It's about the viewers. Your job is to help shape the debate and put it along a track to provide the maximum information for the viewers so they can make their own decisions. This was a failure across the board in that regard last night.
Right, and I don't know if you agree, but a few debates back, the one that the PBS NewsHour teamed up with, I can't remember who, I thought that was the best debate. Very informative, issue-oriented. I'm not sure what you thought about that, Dennis, comparatively speaking.
No, I think that was probably the best of these things. The time limits at sometimes, of course, are a little bit arbitrary. On the other hand, you've got to stop these folks from simply working through their preset talking points and get them to answer a question. Mm-hmm. Specifically, follow-up is always crucial, intelligent follow-up, and we lacked that last night.
Tim Hagel, what did you see last night?
Well, pretty much the same stuff. I certainly agree that the moderators lost control early. And to some extent, it's not entirely their fault, and it's not entirely the fault of the people on the stage, that even with seven people on the stage, they have to basically assert themselves to get some time. And the debates have been a problem all along. My feeling is that if you get beyond three or four people on stage, it's really very difficult for anybody to really shine. And right now, we're at a position just before South Carolina, just before Super Tuesday, when the candidates are, some of them are in kind of a make or break situation. So they really had to push hard. And as a result, it didn't come off very well at all.
Okay, speaking of pushing hard, let's listen to this clip. During the last night's debate, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders was asked about his track record of sympathizing with socialist governments in Cuba, Nicaragua, and if Americans can trust a democratic socialist president not to give these countries a free pass.
I have opposed authoritarianism all over the world, and I was really amazed at what Mayor Bloomberg just said a moment ago. He said that the Chinese government is responsive to the Politburo. But who the hell is the Politburo responsive to? Who elects the Politburo? You got a real dictatorship there? Of course you have a dictatorship in Cuba. What I said is what Barack Obama said in terms of Cuba, that Cuba made progress on education. Yes, I think, really? Really?
Yes,
literacy
programs
no are bad. What Barack Obama said
Obama
is they made great progress on education and health care. That was Barack Obama.
I talked to Barack Obama.
Excuse me. Occasionally, it might be a good idea to be honest about American foreign policy.
Tim Hagel, to you first on this one. How did Bernie Sanders do with the expected onslaught that came through last night, because he is the perceived front runner at this point, with the most delegates as well?
Well, what we heard in that clip is kind of what I was talking about, where this was certainly something where the other candidates were going to challenge Sanders on his comments in the past and so forth. But then all of a sudden, it's interrupting. It's not getting, you know, it's not giving any of the candidates, let alone the moderators, the opportunity to ask a hard question. So it doesn't give them a chance to get Sanders off his basic position or his talking points, or get him to explain some of these prior comments in a more in-depth way. And again, that's really the fault of the format and how many people you've got up there. And so that's going to have to happen in some other form, or if we get later into the process when you have fewer people on stage.
Join our conversation with Tim Hagel and Dennis Goldford, our political scientists, on this Politics Wednesday edition. What do you think of our nominating process? Let's just put together the caucuses, the primary season, and the debates. Throw that all into a basket. Does that equip you to make good decisions? Does that equip our democracy with a process that leads to good nominees? I guess that's a good question. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Dennis, did Bernie Sanders fend off the attackers well enough?
Well enough for his purposes, but well enough for the party generally, no. I mean, what he gave in response, say, to that particular question about literacy, and there's no question that literacy is a good thing, but what he gave us was a version of the apocryphal claim. There's some question about its historical veracity, but the apocryphal claim that Mussolini made the trains run on time. Okay, it's possible for bad people to do good things, but doing good things doesn't make them good people. But what Sanders did and what he's vulnerable to is the charge that there are no enemies to the left. So he left the impression that there must be something good about a dictator because he increased literacy. That's just waiting to be blown out of the water by Republican opponents. And, of course, it was to some extent in limited fashion by Democratic opponents last night.
Mm-hmm. The former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg was asked during last night's Democratic debate if he thought Senator Sanders' vision for the American economy works for more Americans than President Trump's current economic policy.
I think that Donald Trump thinks it would be better if he's president. I do not think so. Vladimir Putin thinks that Donald Trump should be president of the United States, and that's why Russia is helping you get elected, so
Mr.
you'll
Bloomberg.
Lose to him.
Let me tell Mr. Putin, okay, I'm not a good friend of President Xi of China. I think President Xi is an authoritarian leader. And let me tell Mr. Putin, who interfered in the 2016 election, try to bring Americans against Americans. Hey, Mr. Putin, if I'm president of the United States, trust me, you're not going to interfere in any more American elections.
Okay, the backdrop to this, of course, we have to add here, U.S. intelligence officials have concluded that the Russian government is now attempting to interfere in this 2020 presidential race as well. Russia entering the picture. Dennis, what about this angle? Because we had the news reports that Sanders was briefed on potential interference by the Russians about a month ago, right?
Right. And of course, that's throwing a kind of a charge against Trump and the Trump campaign, making the same charge against the Sanders campaign. And of course, he pushed back against that very strongly. I think the key there, though, is not so much that the Russians might prefer this candidate or that candidate. Their interest is creating chaos and questions about the legitimacy of American elections. So their focus is, I think, is less on a particular individual candidate than it is in undermining the integrity of the political system generally, which is a much more fundamental and serious danger.
Okay, let's go to our phones. Dennis Goldford of Drake, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, political scientists. We have listeners who want to join in. 1-866-780-9100. Jim has been waiting in Spencer. Welcome to the program, Jim. Jim, you're on the air. Are you still there?
I'm here.
Very good. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us, Jim, from Spencer.
Well, actually, I had called to enhance the argument to retain Iowa's a first caucus state was my comment. If you want to hear that, I'll go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Well, let me just give a little preface to that. This week, the chair of the Democratic Party in Nevada called for that state to consider ending its caucuses. Iowa and Nevada are not the only caucus states, but they are the most high-profile ones coming so early in the schedule. Now, in a statement, the Iowa Democratic Party spokesman, in response to this Nevada statement, says that the process here emphasizes grassroots organizing required by law. Go ahead and jump in and talk a little bit about your view on the caucuses. We're trying to talk about the nominating process as a whole, but you're jumping into the aspect of the caucuses. What do you think, Jim?
Well, I didn't mean to steer you off course.
No,
I think
that's fine.
You know, Iowa is an excellent place to begin for a lot of the apparent reasons. You know, we're easily traversed and we're fairly well informed. And I think, you know, we do participate at a fair level. But I think the thing that really makes Iowa unique is that it's not beholden to all of the things that many other states already are. You know, we don't have all that big industry. We're not a big union state. We don't have all the military. We don't have Silicon Valley. We don't have things like major population centers and, you know, massive amounts of illegals coming here. We're fairly stable with, you know, the in-migration from other countries. And I think that the thing that makes Iowa really unique is that, you know, we are not a one-issue state. And, you know, we can see a lot of things a little more clearly for that reason.
Mm-hmm. I guess we are also not a very diverse state when you compare us to the rest of the country. Jim, Dennis, comment on Jim, a defender of Iowa caucuses remaining the first. Caucuses as such, Dennis.
Well, you know, it's interesting.
Is there life expectancy low at this point?
I think there the patient's not dead, but the patient's critical. It's way more than serious at this point. It's interesting, in Jim's comment, basically said, if I don't want to put words in his mouth, but as I understood his comments, is that Iowa is completely unlike anywhere else, therefore we're the best place to start. Well, the charge is, because Iowa looks completely unlike anywhere else, whether demographically or industry or size and so forth, it's the worst place to start. I've said for years, and I don't want to offend Iowan sensibilities, but Iowa is not first because it's important. Iowa is important because it's first. In any serial nomination process, whoever starts, U.S. Virgin Islands, Illinois, Iowa, California, will have extra importance simply because of being first. And I had, remember talking to a TV crew of reporters from Scandinavia, one caucus, I think not this one, but the last one, who asked me to explain this whole process to them, and their reaction was essentially, what? This is the way you do this, and you're the most important country in the world? They were just in disbelief that we do our presidential nomination process this way.
Mm-hmm. Let me add to that, Dennis. This is from, I didn't note the author, New York Times commentary. Let me just quote from it, because it matches up with exactly what you're saying, I think, in a way. See if it does. Imagine yourself trying to explain to a foreign visitor who doesn't quite get American politics why journalists and operatives seem so confident about the trajectory of a race in which 3% of delegates are decided after three states in which about 687,000 Democrats have voted, 156,000 of them for Bernie Sanders, representing about 0.2% of the nation's population. That gets at your point as well, doesn't it, Dennis?
Yes, it does. I mean, that's why Hugh Weinbrenner and I subtitled our book, The Making of a Media Event. What Iowa does is nothing more than provide an indicator to the rest of the country of what, not a polling sample, not man-on-the-street interviews, but what real party activists, intensely involved, intensely concerned, and very knowledgeable, think about their array of possible presidential candidates. What the rest of the country does with that information is up to the rest of the country. But, and I'm not a media basher, I'm part of the media, but it tends to be the case that reporters overinterpret all this, and that does a disservice to the caucus process itself.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to another caller, Roger in Washington, Iowa. Roger, thanks for waiting. We have a break coming up, but welcome to the program.
I wanted to say I visited Cuba a number of years ago on an educational tour, and what I observed just as an amateur is that what Bernie Sanders said was absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
They did a great job on medical care everywhere. There were dispensaries that did not have much to dispense, but there was somebody there to provide help. So my comment is, what Bernie Sanders said about Cuba was correct in its facts. That doesn't mean that a communist government is a good thing, but for health care, I believe what he said was correct, and that needs to be recognized. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Roger. Let's go to Steve in the south of Des Moines. Where are you exactly, Steve?
I live a ways off the Cumming Road exit.
Oh, okay. I saw south of Des Moines on my screen here, but that's not really important. What is your comment?
Well, I really think that we need to go to regional primaries throughout the country and make the regions such that the states resemble each other. That is the Midwest, you know, where we grow a lot of corn, beans, and so forth. That ought to be a region for a regional primary. And that should cycle. Whoever goes first, whichever region goes first, ought to cycle year to year. And, you know, it'd take 10 years to get through, or 10 elections to get through, but so be it. Mm-hmm. And in that system, you don't have to give up a caucus if you want to have a formal gathering in regions of Iowa so people can get together and discuss candidates and issues and who's the best and so forth, you can still do that. It doesn't have to be either or.
Okay, Steve, we're coming up on a break. Tim Hagel, comment on that. Alternatives to what we have now as a nominating process, regional primaries, what are the alternatives?
Well, there are a variety of things, regional primaries, or just let other states go first, rotate it, and so forth. But, you know, I'm firmly behind what caller Jim was saying earlier, that I think Iowa's a good state to start with. It doesn't represent, but we don't claim to represent other states. But as he was indicating, our electorate is very informed and very engaged. And so it's a good place for candidates, particularly those that don't have a lot of name recognition or don't have a lot of resources, to at least have an opportunity to start. And that's not going to be the case if you start in a bigger state or if you have a regional primary.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, your thoughts, Dennis.
Well, I would agree with that. As long as journalists don't overinterpret what the caucuses mean, that's been the problem.
Okay, we'll be back in just a minute. Let me slip in this email from one of our listeners just now. Timothy writes, this is going back to some earlier comments, while the audience was being vocal about Bernie Sanders' comments about Castro, it should be noted that Trump has extolled the virtues of Kim Jong-un and Putin many times. Thank you very much for that comment, Timothy. We'll take a short break and be back in just a moment. Continue to talk about the debate from last night, specifically focusing on former Vice President Joe Biden. The Saturday primary in South Carolina, maybe make or break. We'll ask our analysts if it is for the former Vice President, and we'll move on to some other topics as well as the coronavirus. Ask what their thoughts are as the coronavirus may be seen through a political prism. Dennis Goldford is with us, professor of political science at Drake University. Tim Hagel, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. It's Politics Wednesday. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment. Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, our political scientists, picking apart a number of things, analyzing, I should say, a number of things, especially the Democratic debate in South Carolina last night. Of course, that all-important South Carolina primary on Saturday, a few days later, Tuesday, Super Tuesday. Wow, what a delegate haul that will be. Huge states, California, Texas, in on that. We'll talk about that in a moment. But let's talk a little bit more about last night's debate, gentlemen. We had the former Vice President Joe Biden, after the debate, asked by CBS, if he does not win South Carolina on Saturday, will his campaign be able to continue with any hope of securing the Democratic nomination?
I'm going to win South Carolina.
By how much?
I don't know.
Does it matter?
Win. I think it's just important that I win. Just like
1 point is enough.
1 point is enough, but I think I can win by a lot more than that. Look, the African American community knows me, my record. They've known me for the last 40 years. I've kept my word. I've done everything I've said. They know who I am, and it's no, I'm not Johnny come lately to this.
Okay. Dennis, what do you think of that prediction by the vice president?
Well, of course, that's what remains to be seen. But what the vice president has done is put all of his chips at this point on South Carolina.
He's saying that my candidate sinks or swims based upon my finishing first in South Carolina. So he set up expectations for disaster if he does not win South Carolina.
Right, Tim, he doesn't, I mean, let's say he doesn't win South Carolina. Does he have, he's almost shown himself the exit, hasn't he?
Well, I think that was going to be true anyway, because the many people for weeks and weeks, if not months, have been saying that South Carolina was going to be Biden's firewall. He, in fact, initially wasn't even going to compete in Iowa, New Hampshire, and make South Carolina his firewall or his big launching platform, decided that wasn't such a good idea, and then ended up not doing well here in New Hampshire either. I think that if he wins South Carolina even by a little bit, that's enough for him to keep going. A second place finish, if it's somebody other than Sanders, maybe he's still on life support. But if it's Sanders or somebody else or less than a second place finish, he's done.
Mm-hmm. Let's look a little bit on before we move on to the coming days and weeks. Saturday, South Carolina, Super Tuesday, March 3rd, Colorado, California, Minnesota, Texas, a whole bunch of others with a big slew of delegates. Dennis, what do you see in the path here? Could we, after, for instance, next week's Super Tuesday, will we know the likely nominee by this time next week?
Well, I think all we'll know is trajectories. I mean, there are, what, aren't there something like 1,300 or so delegates at stake, 1,400 on Super Tuesday, a big chunk of them. If Sanders were to win them all, or anybody were to win them all, you still wouldn't have that 1,991 you need for a first ballot win, not including the superdelegates. But we may get a sense of trajectory. It could show us that Sanders is ahead of the pack, but doesn't have it wrapped up. It could show us that the Democrats are still pretty much conflicted among themselves as to which direction they should go. So I don't think, despite the fact that, again, there'll be a lot of pressure on commentators to say, okay, this is how it's going to be, period. I think that at best, all we're going to see is a possible trajectories after 9/11, after Super Tuesday.
Tim, do you agree?
Yeah, I think that's true. It's kind of following up on something Dennis was saying before, is that the media sort of portrays this in sort of absolute terms, the way, you know, somebody wins, somebody loses, they're this, they're that. And the other states are going to have their opportunity too. And it's the question is, as well, are there going to be enough people in the other states to say, well, yeah, so-and-so won, but I still like this other person better because he or she is more electable? Are they going to still keep that in mind, or are they going to say, well, it looks like this person has got the momentum behind him or her, and so we're going to go with that? And that's what we have to wait and see, as to how that race develops, and in particular, what happens on Super Tuesday, because if it's a sweep for Sanders, then, you know, maybe he has that trajectory, has that momentum. But if there are sort of mixed results in various ways, then maybe there's still an opportunity for somebody to slow him down.
I'm curious to find out your thoughts, gentlemen, on the conventional wisdom of these so-called lanes. For instance, if Biden's support drops, that goes to another moderate candidate, or if Bernie's has an increase, does that come at the cost of an Elizabeth Warren? What do you think about this lane theory, Dennis?
Well, there's enough there that's accurate to make it plausible. Is it the whole sum and substance? No. I think at one level, there is the question of whether a more progressive liberalism or a more centrist liberalism is the best face to present to the country. But I think more directly, there's the question in terms of electoral strategy. Those advocating a more progressive liberalism, like a Sanders or a Warren, are arguing for the mirror image of the Trump argument, which is that it's a base election. You don't try to persuade anybody to support you. You simply activate and mobilize the people you believe are already there, whether they voted in the past or not. That's the Sanders-Warren argument. Sanders says he's going to win by activating all these folks who've never voted and participated before. So far, there is absolutely no evidence of that in the first three events. The other side, which is the Buttigieg and Biden and Klobuchar argument is that you win by trying to extend your support beyond that base to those disaffected Republicans and independents who might be willing to consider voting for a Democrat because they don't like what President Trump has offered them. So that's the argument. Which strategy is the better one, the more fruitful one that could lead to a victory?
So we don't know whether it's a base election or what is the other type of election that's not a base election, would you say?
No, it's seeing as opposed to a base election, which is all your true believers, it's the idea of an electoral support as a coalition.
So sort of would Obama in 08 be an example of that?
I think so, yes. I think that's the case, because look at all the states he won. And, of course, the problem in 2016 was Hillary Clinton thought that was a Democratic coalition. It turned out to be a specifically Obama coalition, which left her out in the cold in three states to which she didn't pay much attention: Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin.
It's Politics Wednesday edition with Dennis Goldfert, River to River, with Tim Hagel as well. I'm Ben Kiefer. Join our conversation. We want to talk about coronavirus here in just a moment. Yesterday in India, President Trump spoke about how the U.S. had been handling the coronavirus with efficiency, trying to reassure Americans, U.S. health officials, that they were very close to a vaccine for a deadly coronavirus. It was interesting that Republican Senator Roy Blunt emerged from a briefing on the virus and said the vaccine won't be available for a year, maybe 18 months, even if scientists around the world race to develop one. Also, we heard from many politicians. U.S. Senator Patty Murray, she spoke at a Senate Labor, Health, and Human Services Appropriations Subcommittee about the concerns the U.S. may be facing in the coming weeks. Let's hear President Trump followed by Senator Murray back-to-back here and then get comments from our analysts.
You may ask about the coronavirus, which is very well under control in our country. We have very few people with it, and the people that have it are, in all cases, I have not heard anything other. Maybe there's something new, because for 2 days I haven't been seeing too much of that news, of very much news, because it's been very all-encompassing. We've accomplished a lot here. We had a lot of meetings, as you know. But the people are getting better. They're all getting better.
At the administration's briefing this morning on the coronavirus, we're told by the experts at NIH, CDC, that there is a very strong chance of an extremely serious outbreak of the coronavirus here in the United States.
Okay. So with those and other comments that you've consumed, no doubt, Tim and Dennis, in the media, Tim, let me start with you. What do you think of the political dimensions of this coronavirus outbreak?
Well, it's unfortunate that there are political dimensions to it, really. To some extent, you see a number of Democrats coming out and complaining that the Trump administration is not doing enough, which may be true, but it's hard to assess that if you have one side coming out and saying, oh, yeah, no problem, we've got it under control, and the other side came in, oh, it's going to be a disaster kind of a thing. And it just makes what's potentially something that is very serious, it puts it on those political terms, and it makes it then hard for people to sort out, as is the case for a lot of these political issues. But, you know, this is something we're talking about, the potential for a worldwide pandemic and lots of people being infected and dying and so forth. And so this is something that we should try to put the politics aside. It's going to be hard to do that, but we'll see.
You referenced the Trump administration. They're seeking billions of dollars in additional funding from Congress to buy protective gear, work on treatments and this vaccine for the virus. That a Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the funding plan that they asked for is, in her words, long overdue, completely inadequate to the scale of this emergency. Dennis, your view on the political dimensions here.
Well, I would say, first of all, with regard to the president's comment, the question is how he meant what he said. If he really believes what he was saying, that's simply scientific ignorance. He has no idea of how all that stuff works and how it functions. On the other hand, if he was saying it in order to calm the public and prevent a panic, that is something that's very important to do. We don't want a panic, because that causes all sorts of other problems, political and in terms of basic safety and security, no question about that. but it's one of the central jobs of the president and the executive branch to keep the country safe, both from foreign attack, domestic disorder, and fending off various sorts of challenges. And any administration is legitimately subject to criticism if, in fact, it turns out that that administration is completely unprepared for the kind of difficulties that might be facing us.
Yes, interesting. There's the actual threat of the coronavirus that science can help us understand. But then there is, Dennis, what you're talking about, the perceived threat that reaches into the political sphere.
Absolutely. I mean, I joke, and Tim probably has the same situation in Iowa. I joke that if I put a Petri dish on the desk next to me in a classroom within 50 minutes, it'll be the size of a rose bush, you know, because when people live together in dorms or things like that, you've got colds and flu and everything going around. And so, you know, you want to make sure that you don't catch things from other people. But you can, you know, there's a healthy concern about, you know, washing your hands all the time. That's different from becoming a germaphobe, in which you just simply want to wear a hazmat suit just to go through your daily activities. The former is caution, the latter is panic, and you don't want to create a panic.
Let me ask the two of you, we've got less than 10 minutes in our conversation this hour. Let me pivot to the president's view, his actions toward our intelligence community. Your thoughts, Tim, you first on this, on Donald Trump's recent decision to replace the acting director of National Intelligence, Joseph McGuire, with a person who has no intelligence experience, Rick Grenell, or Grenell. He will be acting. It will expire next month. But McGuire, the former acting director of National Intelligence, was replaced along with several of his deputies, reportedly fired because an official in his office briefed Congress without Trump's knowledge on Russia's ongoing election interference. The president was angered that Congress was informed about this latest Russian election interference. Now, is that typical for a president to sort of try to control the intelligence information that Congress gets?
Well, whenever you start to say, is it typical, and you're talking about President Trump, that's his whole thing, is that he is different, and that's what got him elected, and that's what a lot of people want. They want, you know, to use the phrase that's often used, is to drain the swamp, and to some extent, maybe that's what's going on here from their perspective. But yeah, to a certain extent, presidents do want to control the information that Congress gets. That's really not that unusual. It's unusual, perhaps, in the way that a particular president, Trump in this case, has gone about it in terms of somewhat publicly firing people and having more turnover and a lot of these things and just flat out public criticism of some of these folks, whereas other presidents might have done it more quietly.
Mm-hmm. Housemakers, the House in Democratic hands, House lawmakers last week briefed about that Russian interference in the 2020 campaign. President Trump angry. What do you think, Dennis, about what we think is sort of, it looks like the Trump trying to keep the flow of information from coming out of these agencies and keeping that firmly in his grip?
Well, all presidents seek to maximize their power. There are always tensions between Congress and the president and the courts. I mean, that's a feature, that's not a bug, if you will, of our separation of powers. This particular president really pushes the bounds on that. There is a theory of the unitary presidency, that the president is solely accountable for everybody, but that means that everybody has to do exactly what the president wants when the president wants it in the executive branch. This precedes President Trump, but there is a churning in the numbers of people in the top positions that is, as Tim said, very atypical in this particular case. And in any organization, you want to have confidence that the right people are in the right jobs and will be left alone to do the jobs they're assigned to do and for which they're suited. And if there's just constant churning, I don't want to fly in an airplane when somebody comes in and takes the pilot out before we take off, and then before that pilot can take the plane off, somebody comes in and takes the substitute pilot off. I don't want to fly in that airplane.
In our final 5 minutes, let me get your views on this development. Yesterday, the president criticizing the two liberal Supreme Court justices, Justice Sonia Sotomayor and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. He referenced a dissenting opinion and also a years-old comment by, that was the one by Ginsburg. Let me just read the president's tweet. He quotes at the beginning Laura Ingraham of Fox News. Sotomayor accuses the GOP of appointed justices of being biased in favor of Trump. Then Trump's tweet continues, "This is a terrible thing to say. Try to shame some into voting her way? Question mark. She never criticized Justice Ginsburg when she called me a faker. Both should recuse themselves." So, Tim Hagel, you have a legal background. You first on this. Why is the president doing this? Does the president have the right to recall for recusal of Supreme Court justices in this way?
Well, recusal of any judge, for that matter, not just the justices of the Supreme Court, is purely up to them. They can choose to do so or not.
It's up to the individual judge or justice.
Up to the individual judge or justice. There's no hard and fast rule along those lines. Sometimes they do it if there's an obvious conflict of interest, and they're usually very careful about that. And as far as Ginsburg's comment, she walked that back, basically said, "I shouldn't have spoken out in that way." And we really don't expect the justices to do that for the most part. And so it was a little unusual for Sotomayor to kind of go after the administration the way she did in that dissent. And in fact, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, Republican, of course, complained. He said, "Well, this is a little like the arsonist complaining about the noise of the fire trucks," which is to say, what Sotomayor was complaining about was the fact that the government was filing a lot of requests to have injunctions stayed. In other words, that people would go in and say the Trump administration did this bad thing, ask a court to have an injunction on it. An injunction would be granted, and then the court administration would go in, "Well, we need a stay on the injunction," meaning let us go ahead and do whatever it was that we wanted to do. And Sotomayor is complaining about that. Well, if they didn't have injunctions, then they wouldn't have to ask for stays. It's basically the argument that Cruz and others are making. And so you kind of have made your bed, and now you have to lie in it.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, what are your thoughts on this call by the president for recusal by that these two justices should recuse themselves?
Sure. The president likes to throw sand in people's eyes and just confuse the matter and raise questions about the legitimacy of various traditional norms and procedures. Maybe that's draining the swamp. Maybe that's so atypical it's illegitimate. People have to make their own decisions. But it's never been the case that dissenting in a case, in a decision that might uphold governmental power, disqualifies a dissenter from hearing another case that's brought by that government. That would simply undermine the entire judicial process.
Mm-hmm. And so we expect maybe this is a one-tweet wonder, so to speak.
Well, I don't know if anything's a one-tweet wonder in this particular administration, but it's just another one of a series of similar sorts of tweets attempting to leverage the president's position as favorably as possible against what might be traditional constraints and limits on presidential power.
And I would just say, too, that it might be a one tweet only in the sense that he's a counterpuncher. So he felt the need to speak out since Sotomayor did. If it doesn't happen again from the court, then he'll probably be quiet about it.
One loose end, and we have 1 minute to take care of it. An email from Doug in Rockwell City. Can you give some detail about the Democratic superdelegates? How many, their handicaps, et cetera. So, Dennis, a comment on superdelegates. That was a big thing in 2016, wasn't it?
Yes. Again, the superdelegates are people who are delegates to the National Convention not because they've been chosen in primaries, but because they are party officials or office holders. So, for example, Cindy Axne from the 3rd District, Abby Finkenauer from the 1st, Dave Loebsack from the 2nd, as Democratic members of the House of Representatives, would be entitled to attend and vote at the Democratic National Convention in that sense. And I won't go into the history of why they were put back there, but this time around, there's, Tim, what is it, 7-11, 7-41, something like that this time. They cannot vote on the first round if they're for the presidential nomination. If nobody gets a majority, on that first round, then superdelegates are allowed to vote in a second ballot. There hasn't been one, I think, since 1952. But in fact, also the pledge delegates, if there is nobody wins a majority on the first round, they get to decide to change their votes as well on a second round. So, you know, we observers would find all this fascinating. It would probably be disastrous for the Democratic Party if it got that far.
Okay, we hope that answered your question. Doug in Rockwell City, thanks for that question via email. Dennis Goldford, thank you for that answer. And to all the other analysis you and Tim Hagel have given us this hour, we appreciate you coming by. Dennis Goldford, professor of political science at Drake University. Tim Hagel, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Tim, Dennis, we appreciate your time.
Always a pleasure.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow on the program, we're going to look at pardons. Way back in 1795, George Washington granted the very first presidential pardon in men convicted in the so-called Whiskey Rebellion. We'll talk about that with presidential historian Tim Walch and Dennis's colleague, political scientist Rachel Caulfield, tomorrow on the program. River to River, produced by Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, and Matt Alvarez. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.